experiences. We have certainly things unexpected that occur to us, troubles, difficulties, challenges that come along our way. Sometimes a church building loses electricity and you just kind of deal with it as we found out this morning. But sometimes what we encounter is a real crisis. They come unexpectedly. They come, as it were, out of the blue. They come ferociously into our lives, unrelentingly, it seems. Someone has said, if you can keep your head when all those around you are losing theirs, you don't understand the situation. And there may be some truth in that. But crises do come into our lives. I want to talk to you from Acts, the 12th chapter, this evening for a few moments about a crisis that came into the lives of some of our brethren from long ago, and see if there aren't some lessons that we can learn from the way they dealt with these very difficult circumstances that arose. And there are four things I want to suggest to you, and I hope you'll put them down because you will need them. Some of you may need them right now. You may very well right now be dealing with some crisis in your life. But if you're not, you will. And I believe Acts chapter 12 offers to us some good insight on how to deal with such circumstances. Let's look at those first 10 verses of chapter 12 in the book of Acts. Now, about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now it was during the days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God. And on the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains. Guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell. And he struck Peter's side and roused him, saying, "Get up quickly." And his chains fell off his hands. The angel said to him, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and continued to follow. And he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. And when they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. As I say to you, this is an account of a real crisis that arose. I think probably when we think about this event, as I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, we probably think in terms of this crisis that arose, that affected James and Peter, and it most certainly did. But I hasten to draw your attention to verse 1, where it says, about that time Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. The indication seems to be that this was something more extensive than just James and Peter, but rather that it was something that affected several who were members of the Lord's church, and thus they had to deal with it. But even if it was just to affect James and Peter, nonetheless, it was a real experience in the lives of these men. And they alone, I think, demonstrate to us how to deal with a crisis. I want to suggest to you, as I said, these four things about this matter. And from the standpoint of how Christ is able to help us in every crisis. He is the Christ of every crisis. And the first thing I would suggest to you is that what we must do when we face a crisis is that we must respect God's providence and the mystery of God's providence. The word providence, you can almost hear the accompanying words of provide or providing or of provision. And to speak of God's providence is just simply to speak about God's provision, God's making provision for His people. And I say here that we must respect the mystery of God's providence because the Scriptures just don't give us a revelation of all of the ways in which God is willing to act on our behalf in order to provide for us. The New Testament many times speaks about the gospel of Christ as having been a mystery at one time. That is, it was something unexplained. It was unrevealed. Every New Testament passage, by the way, that speaks about the mystery of the gospel or the mystery of Christ speaks in the same context about it now being revealed. The point is that when you talk about the gospel and what God planned to do and what God intended to do through Christ, though it at one time in human history was a mystery, it was unexplained and unrevealed, it has now been explained. It has now been revealed. It's what the New Testament writers have to say about it. When we talk about God's providence, however, we're not talking about a subject that has been revealed. We're not talking about something that has been explained in its entirety. But nonetheless, Scriptures do, and I think this is one such passage, but other passages do speak to us about the fact that God will act for His people and God will provide for His people. Well, when we read these verses about this particular crisis, many questions might come to our minds. I suspect they came to the minds of these people in the church in the days of Peter and James. They're the same questions that probably come to your mind and to my mind when we face some sort of crisis. And that is chiefly, why? Why is this happening? I mean, can you not imagine how some folks thought, why is Herod even the king? Why has God permitted this? Where is God? Why is this man, this evil man, this vile man who is doing these things to us, why is he permitted to be king? Why is James killed and Peter released? Does God have favorites? Has God lost control of things? And it's all just simply at the mercy of chance and what might occur. Why do these things happen? Well, I would say to you that we need to remember that we do not live by explanations as children of God. We live by promises. By promises that God has made to us. And everything about this life and the occurrences in this life and the vagaries of this life are not going to be explained to us. Someone has made the observation that this life is not a mystery to be solved. Rather, it is a life to be lived. And sometimes that means going through circumstances and dealing with crises that arise in our life without getting a full explanation and a full understanding of why this is happening. I'll tell you, one of the most detrimental things we can do to our faith is to demand understanding, to demand that some sort of explanation be given to me. I mean, if God wants me to be His and wants me to be faithful to Him and to be resolute, then He's got to give me some answers. That is destined to destroy a faith. You look at the men and women that you read about in the Scriptures, men and women of faith, who went through circumstances hard to understand, circumstances that no doubt would have raised these same questions in their minds, but they went through them without making the demand to God, "You explain this to me." The one that comes to my mind first and foremost in all that is Joseph. What happened to that young boy, that teenage boy? The Bible tells us he was 17 years old when his brothers sold him into slavery. Taken off into this distant land, left alone there. And yet that teenage boy had enough faith to go through those difficult times. And I'm not saying he didn't wrestle with those difficulties, but he had enough faith to go through those times without demanding that God give him an answer, an explanation of why these things were occurring. We do not live by explanations. We live by promises. Well, you think about what these folks in James's and Peter's day were looking at. They were looking at Herod's ungodly power. They were looking at James's death. They were looking at Peter's arrest and apparent imminent death as well. Don't you think that they would have been tempted to have asked or to have made the observation that we may many times make, "This just doesn't make sense to me"? And you know, I understand that. There are things that happen. Crises that arise in the lives of people that I'm close to, that I have to say, it doesn't make sense to me. But what I have to remind myself of, and what I think that we all have to remind ourselves of, is that just because it doesn't make sense to me doesn't mean it doesn't make sense. There is a God who understands all things, who knows all things, who sees ahead all things before they happen and occur. And we need to be confident in the provisions that that God will make for us. I kind of equate this to, I've never spent a lot of time doing this, but I have on occasions come across, you know, when you're just channel surfing on TV, I've come across a program where there's a fellow painting a picture, and he's just slapping up colors here and there, and it's amazing to see him work, and he does what he's capable of doing, and you begin to see this picture taking shape, and it's a beautiful landscape. And then all of a sudden, he takes a brush and just slashes on a paint. And I think, "Man, what are you doing? Are you out of your mind? You just ruined the picture." But he continues to work, and soon it becomes obvious that what he did was he put a tree in the foreground of that picture. And what I thought had ruined it actually made it. Made it more beautiful. And I tell you, that's what God can do. That's what God does do. In our lives, He knows the plan. He knows what needs to be done. He knows what's best. And He acts in that regard. I think a lot of times we kind of think about life like a road that we travel. And we go along and life is good and things are going the way we want them to. And boy, this is a good piece of road. And everything is just great. And then we hit a bad stretch of road. Oh, I can't wait till this bad stretch of road is over. And then everything will be back to being good, as though nothing bad is going to ever happen again. But life is really not like a road. Life is really more like a railroad track. You have two rails running parallel to one another. One rail is good. One rail is bad. One rail is the good things that happen to us in our lives, and one rail is the bad things, the crises that crop up over our life. And we have to deal with them both as life unfolds before us. So the first thing I would suggest to you that we must do is to respect the mystery of God's providence and have confidence in the fact that God is going to act in our own best regard, in our own best interest. But now I also would suggest to you that we need to request the ministry of God's people. We need to request the help of God's people. Verse 5 of our text says that Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God. Prayer for him was being made. This is a great verse on prayer. Prayer, notice, was made for him by the church to God. Those are three great phrases about what prayer is all about. There seemed to be no hope for Peter. Think for a minute about the situation that he was in. He had been seized and put into prison. Four squads of soldiers oversaw him. He was kept between two soldiers. He was chained with two chains. Guards were posted in front of the prison. He was sentenced to death. I think of a line that comes out of a movie. It's an old John Wayne movie, if you're interested. But I think Peter must have been tempted to have said this same thing. And that was, you must think I'm a real dangerous fellow. I mean, look at where he was. What more hopeless kind of situation could you imagine? This was a crisis, folks, in which there was seemingly no way of deliverance out of. But now I want you to think about what we can know about the prayer that was being prayed on this occasion. If there is a mystery of God's providence, there is also a ministry of God's people. Notice the frequency of their prayer, or at least what I take to be an implication of the frequency of their prayer. It says in verse 5, in the New American Standard, it says that they fervently, they were praying fervently. Some versions render that they were praying unceasingly. They were continuously praying on behalf of Peter. No questions seemingly about, well, why doesn't God do something? Why doesn't God answer? They seem to have a grasp of the fact that God's delays are not God's denials. They seem to have a grasp of what Jesus was teaching over in the book, in the Gospel of Luke, in the 18th chapter. And in the first verse, where Luke says simply, he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not lose heart. I'll tell you what will get you through a crisis. It is to pray always, not lose heart. I believe the King James says not to faint. That is, don't quit, don't give up. It's exactly what the Apostle Paul would tell the Thessalonians about praying without ceasing. But secondly, I would say to you that we ought to be impressed with the fervency of their prayer, as the New American Standard uses that word. That is the intensity of their prayer. The fact that it went on continuously, that they continued to pray, that they were unceasing in their prayer for him, is an indication of how fervent they were about this. I think as well about the fellowship that is demonstrated in their prayer. The text says that this was a prayer that was made by the church. They were together in their prayer for Peter. And that's a powerful impact. That's a powerful weapon, if you will, in our arsenal, in the struggle that we're involved in with evil. It is the prayer of one another, for one another, made to God. And that's another element of this prayer that is impressive. That is the faith that is demonstrated by it. Their prayer was offered to God. And we need to know how important this is and what it indicates there. It's interesting. These folks didn't get together and say, okay, we need to get up a petition that we can take to the governmental officials and petition for Peter's release. They didn't gather up money to go off and bribe some government official. They didn't organize a march to go out and to demand the release of Peter. They prayed to God. Now, the world may very well find that an occasion to laugh about, the idea of praying. The idea that you can talk to a God and that something can be affected and it can affect a change in circumstances. The world will find that an occasion to laugh at. You want to know who doesn't laugh at that? The devil doesn't laugh at that. The last thing the devil wants to see is a group of God's people gathered together praying to God to relieve the circumstances of some crisis. And then finally, I'm impressed with the focus of their prayer. They prayed. They prayed to God. And they prayed for Peter. They prayed for him. Verse 5 says. May I ask you this? You just answer in your own mind. Do you know what you prayed for about 20 minutes ago? I think maybe sometimes. Prayer may just become sort of it's a part of the service. It's a few minutes that is scheduled into what we do here, and it's done and it's completed and we can move on to the next item. Do you suppose that's the way these folks were praying? I don't. I think they had a real focus about what they were praying for. Now, when you're in a crisis, you need to respect the mystery of God's providence. And you need to request the ministry of God's people. And then thirdly, you need to rest in the mastery of God's peace. Verse 6. Right? And these are just amazing verses in one respect. On the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, what was Peter doing? He's asleep. I don't know if you've ever thought about this. We have a few, scriptures that give us some insight into what brethren were doing when they were put in prison because of their faith. You remember it, Acts chapter 16? Paul and Silas are cast into prison in Philippi. What are they doing? They're singing. Peter is thrown into prison here in chapter 12. What is he doing? Well, he's sleeping. And sleeping apparently very soundly. I don't know about Peter. Peter might have been like me. Robin just gets irritated about how I can sleep anywhere. Get on a plane, I'll sleep. Sit down at somewhere in the house, I can go to sleep. I just anywhere, anytime. And it just frustrates her. I tell her, well, all it takes is a clear conscience. And she says, or no conscience. But Peter, it seems to me, is resting, confident, secure. The angel, verse 7, had to wake him up. in order to set him on his way out of the prison. Now that's peace in the midst of a crisis. That's a man who's not afraid to die. I've said it to you here before, and I'm sure you've heard it other places as well. A man's not really ready to live until he's no longer afraid to die. And Peter's not afraid to die. Why? Well, it's because he's already seen someone who died and who came back to life. He has seen the risen Lord. And in the lives of men and women who are Christians, who are passing through the midst of some great crisis, whose very lives might be on the line, while death is always a mystery to us and there are uncertainties about it, in the final analysis, it is no longer the overwhelming enemy that it once was. Because to the Christian, they know death has been conquered. And though they die, remember, James died. Though they die, they know that they will live again. Peter was not afraid of death, so he slept soundly. He knows his brethren pray for him. And so he sleeps soundly. He's aware of God's presence and of God's providence. And so he sleeps soundly. I tell you, Peter was probably the most guarded man there ever was. We've read about what the governmental officials did, what Herod did to place a guard around this man. Turn over to Philippians chapter 4. Listen to what Paul says in Philippians 4, verses 6 and 7. He says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." Now, look at verse 7. "And the peace of God," that's what we're talking about, "the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, shall" what? "Shall guard." It shall guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Peter was a well-guarded man. Not because of what Herod did, but because of what God had done and what Jesus had done. And you and I can be well-guarded men and women, having our hearts, our minds secure, even to the point that when all others around us are losing theirs, we're still able to keep our heads. Not because we don't have an appreciation for the circumstances, but because we know our hearts and our minds are guarded by the peace of God that passes all understanding. The final thing I would suggest to you is that we need to rejoice in the majesty of God's power. Had God lost control when these things happened there in Jerusalem? When James was killed, had God lost control? When Peter was arrested? You know, some people might think, well, God is weak and he can't do anything about this. Others might think, well, God doesn't care and he won't do anything about these things. And facing our crises, we may think the same way. But Peter's deliverance came. You say, oh, but what about James? Well, what about James? Yes, James died. James died at the hands of Herod. Let's assume James didn't die then. You know what was going to happen to James? He was going to die. Later on, he was going to die. The crisis that you face now, or maybe the crisis that you face in the future, it may take your life. Or it may not. But I'll tell you what's going to happen to you in the future. You're going to die. You're going to leave this life. So what if God doesn't deliver us from the crisis that we face? It's not because He can't. If God is not working for our well-being in ways that you can see, it doesn't mean that God is not working. If evil seems to succeed during our crisis, remember that the success of evil is only temporary. I love a little statement that Woodrow Wilson one time made. He said, "I would rather temporarily fail with a cause that will ultimately succeed than to temporarily succeed with a cause that must ultimately fail." And that's what you and I are involved in. We are involved in a cause that must ultimately succeed. And circumstances may occur that make it seem as though it's failing or that it's going to fail. But it must ultimately succeed. So, are you in a crisis? Don't demand to understand. You remember the resource of prayer that you have. You look to God. Rest in His peace. And you expect God's power to overcome in His own time and in His own way. Are you serving God with your life? That's what these people were doing. The ones we know of, the Peter and James, with their lives, they were serving God. But remember, the verse said that Herod was vexing some. There were others, those that we don't know, who were with their lives serving God. Are you doing that? That's the only way that you're ever going to be able to go through a crisis in the way that we've talked about. So if you're not serving Him, why don't you begin to do so today? Give your obedience to Him, believing that Jesus is God's Son. Turn away from your sins. Confess your faith in Jesus. This evening, be washed, be cleansed of your sins by being baptized. We bid you to do that while we stand and sing together.